Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM with Declan Ralph and Dave Daly.
Hi there and welcome to the programme. I'm Declan Ralph.
And I'm Dave Daly.
Coming up on the programme today, in a moment, myself and Dave will discuss some of the current business headlines from the local and national papers. In the business of this week, well, we have a double feature on the business of self-publishing. We'll be talking to Barbara Higgins, author of The Torchbearers. And after that, a recording from the Dublin Tech Summit earlier in the year when Near FM's Declan Mina spoke with Kinga from PublishDrive.com.
David Bell from the HR department will be here after that for the regular look at HR issues. This week, David is talking to Declan about maternity, paternity and parental leave from an employer's point of view.
And finally then, Brian Green will be here to give us more detail on something we touched briefly on last week. We talked about his latest business venture, which is called Pirate.ie. And I just felt we didn't do it justice last week, so we're going to chat about it a little bit more in a little bit more detail. Now, if you have something you'd like to say to us, or you'd like to get involved in the discussion or comment on any of the stories, you can contact the show by text while we are on the air to 087 69 44 500. That's 087 69 44 500. Or you can contact us anytime on Twitter. And on Twitter, we are on @nearby_business, #localbiz.
Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM with Declan Ralph and Dave Daly.
So Dave, let's have a chat about what's happening in the papers, both locally, a little bit further afield, of course, and keeping an eye on how it impacts us here in northeast Dublin. First off, we have Junior Enterprise being launched.
Yeah, the Junior Entrepreneur Programme, known as the JEP, has launched its 2019 recruitment programme, inviting primary schools across the island to participate in its entrepreneurship programme. The programme centres on primary school children in 5th and 6th class learning about the entrepreneurship skills and launching classroom businesses. The businesses range from manufacturing clocks, games or books to designing solutions for everyday problems. And since it was founded in 2010, JEP has given more than 50,000 primary school pupils the opportunity to experience practical real-life business learning as part of their formative education. And in 2018, the 12,000 children across 480 classes who each invested a small amount each, their own money from their piggy banks. The businesses achieved sales of 220,000 and the net profit, this is a good one for anybody out there who runs a small business on small margins, was 140,000, over 50% margin. The funds belong to the children and the use of those funds is decided by the children. It's usually a combination of returning the investment and profit to the children's charitable contributions and other class treats. I say the treats are great fun. JEP gives children an extra chance to learn about the real world before they've got to make decisions about what to study in second level, said the chairman and Tweak.com founder Jerry Keneally. It gives children the opportunity to do something for themselves, to invest their money and get back a profit yet they've made for themselves, of course. Along the way, they learn the importance of entrepreneurs in the community and find out what they're good at.
Excellent, yeah, and Jerry Keneally is a great guy. He made a lot of money selling his business down there in Kerry, but he's a good guy for giving back to other entrepreneurs and particularly for young children. Did you ever do anything like that when you were at school?
I'm afraid not. We did very little.
My claim to fame is that we had the forerunner of this back in the 80s or maybe the 70s, I'm not quite sure when it was, but where we had a scheme like this, we made cuddly tigers, we made a profit, and we even appeared on The Late Late Show.
Very good.
Dave is always stuck for words
when I
tell him
it all started. Did you wear your white jacket
I didn't wear my white jacket that night. The entries as well, we move on quickly from that. The entries are welcome now as well, Dave, for the SFA Small Business Awards. That's coming up shortly.
Yeah, from Small Business People to Small Firms Association, the National Small Business Awards 2019 have been opened for entries. The awards were launched in Dublin last week by Leo Varadkar, Taoiseach. The aim is to recognise the achievements of small businesses in Ireland and the contribution to the wider economy. The SME sector is crucial to the success of the Irish economy, making a huge contribution to jobs and economic growth, said Mr. Varadkar. Each of these jobs is the result of enterprising and determined people who have turned ideas into businesses, creating employment and injecting life into our cities and towns. The owner-managers and their employees work incredibly hard to make an important contribution to the local community and our economy. The SFA National Small Business Awards are a great way to showcase the many success stories. Companies employing fewer than 50 people have until the 19th of October to enter online at sfa.ie. And there will be a gala dinner, of course, in March 2019.
Excellent. You've an interesting question, I believe, to pose about golf courses.
How much would you pay for a golf course in County Wicklow? And that's not just for a round.
Not just for a round of golf. Well, I suppose if you were buying a golf course, I don't know, a couple of million, three, five million maybe?
This one seems to be a bit of a bargain. It was marketed for $650,000 and investor Ian Lucy has acquired a golf club in County Wicklow and is ploughing over $3 million into making it a high-tech adventure centre. He and other investors bought Ballinastow Golf Club in Roundwood, which is on the market for, as I said, $650,000. And most of the $3 million finance for the first phase has been secured and further fundraising will follow. We are calling it the Outdoors Club, he said. It will be a golf, hike and adventure club, and we want to get away from the stuffy wood panel club types of the past. The idea is revolutionary and how golf is played and managed. The clubhouse will be rebuilt as an environmental self-sufficient building with facilities for sports clubs and people doing adventure activities as well as golf.
The business of on Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM.
Now, in the business of this week, a double feature on the business of self-publishing. And in about 10 minutes or so, or thereabouts, we're going to hear from an interview that took place at the Dublin Tech Summit earlier in the year. Our very own Near FM's Declan Mina, he spoke with a lady called Kinga from a company called PublishDrive.com, who told them all about self-publishing and the changes in the publishing industry. But before that, Dave is going to chat with Barbara Higgins. Barbara is the author of The Torchbearers, a newly published thriller. Barbara was born in Cork, but now lives in Dublin with her husband, three kids and two dogs. She studied economics, worked in the Irish financial services industry for many years, but is now focused full-time on writing.
Yeah, the world of publishing can be extremely competitive, and somewhere between 600,000 and a million books published every year in the US. And it's estimated that around half of those are self-published and sell fewer than 250 copies. But a successful self-publisher can make a lot of money. Now, arguably the most well-known self-publisher ever, a lady called Erica Mitchell, had never written a word before 2009 when she joined a fan fiction website for admirers of the Twilight saga. Then a studio manager from High Wycombe, England, became enthralled with the possibilities writing had offered her and decided to take her fan fiction one step further. She self-published a book, you may have heard of it, called 50 Shades of Grey under the nom de plume E.L. James, and the rest, as we know, was history. Now, we would like to welcome Barbara to the studio, and she's here in person, sitting beside me, and
pleasure,
very quietly like a
here.
Mouse. You're welcome, Barbara, and well done. First of all, your book is lovely. It's sitting beside us here on the table. Before we get into the business side, can you just tell us a little bit about the book itself?
Absolutely, Dave. Well, I mean, at its heart, it's a thriller. It's a triple murder whodunit, really, when it comes down to it. It unfolds in a setting of Prospero, which is a fictional town, a reincarnated ghost town in deepest southern New Mexico in the States. And this town is very steeped in religious fundamentalism. Our main protagonist, Ariel, is a burnt out fund manager, a hedge fund partner, on the verge of a nervous breakdown, basically, and looking for sanctuary. And you know, Ariel, in the mould of the kind of spaghetti westerns I grew up on, is a stranger comes to town, making the locals feel uncomfortable. And then we have Mike Argyle, who's a local police officer. And Mike effectively witnesses a pretty macabre double murder while with someone he shouldn't be with and doing something he shouldn't be doing. And basically the story, or the main arc of the story, takes off when those three points of conflict collide. And it goes from there. So
very good. Sounds like a very good read. And tell us about your own route to self-publishing.
So, like many prospective authors, writers, I did go and give the traditional route a try. I suppose that's the dream. You know, you walk into the shop, you're going to see there your book and the glossy shelves there in Hodges Figgis or what have you. And I guess as well, if you go the traditional route, it does free you up then to just crack on with the next novel, and everything's kind of taken care of in the background. So, I did I got, you know, I wrote the manuscript and then took that big step where you seek out an editor. And, you know, that's very nerve-wracking for anybody. I was very lucky in the people I worked with. I worked with a guy called Robert Doran and another lady called Irene Graham. I think it's really important to say, find a really good editor, because it just saves you so much time and improves your writing massively. And then after that, I got reader feedback. And then, you know, straight away started submitting to agents. And first of all, you have to get an agent. You can't directly submit to a publisher. You have to get an agent. And everything takes a lot of time. Like, be prepared for everything takes 6 months at least. So I did the round of submissions and eventually did get an agent, which I was told by everybody, oh, you're home and hose. That's fantastic. That's the result you wanted. And then she submitted. She was an American agent. She submitted to publishers in the US. And that took a whole other year. And now, you know, now you're down to, and she was unsuccessful, even though we got sort of very close, but no cigar. Lots of, oh, it's great, but, and there was just a lot of buts. So you kind of feel like, oh, you're nearly there. But at the same time, I felt the story was going to go out of date, because now you have Trump in the presidency and the book has quite a lot of political angles to it. And it's, you know, kind of current and topical. And I felt if I waited any longer, I would just begin to lose its currency in terms of its, you know, like it was going to become a bit obsolete or whatever. So I did a lot of research, and then I decided, right, no, I'm going to crack on and do this myself. And then, you know, while I'm not an expert, but I would have a kind of a to-do list for people if they have a book that they think is worthy of publishing. And like I said, if they've put it into the hands of a good editor, and if they have gotten honest God reader feedback, like not your other half or your mother or whatever. I mean, somebody who is
objective.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, because just don't do it unless you've done that bit. Right. But I would say go with there are self-publishing companies now, because, see, what's happened is Amazon are now the 600-pound gorilla out there in the market. They control 40% of all books sold in the world, like 40%, you know, so like they're like, and 70% of all books sold online. Mm-hmm. So they have totally, and they've opened up the market to self-publishing, so they have a lot more product, and some would say a lot lower quality, but they have changed totally the dynamics of the market. And as a result, there's a whole new raft of companies have started up who are self-publishing service companies. So they don't own the rights to your book or anything like that, but they will assist you in getting the book over the line. And there are really good ones of those. And then there are guys who are selling fool's gold, and you really have to be careful, you know, not to sort of. So I worked with a company called Kazoo Publishing. I couldn't recommend them more highly. There are a number of them out there. But what they do is they give you you pay them money. Now, this is an investment. So you have to decide, like, am I going to invest in this? Because, like I said, 250 books a year, you know, you're never going to make any money if you are one of the 250 book a year people. But if you do believe, and you know, then I would say invest, and the more you invest, the better potential you have to see a return. Just speaking of, like, not artistically, but like a business, and you have to really kind of, it does come down to that in the end. So what they will do is they'll give you the further editorial input. They will have the proofreading, typesetting, and then they'll help you with the art and design of the cover. You have a lot of input into it, though, which you don't if you go through a publishing company. Mm. So your product at the end of the day has your fingerprints all over it. Mm. But unless you want to become an expert on typesetting, proofreading, all the other things.
Use the experts, yeah.
Just go with the, you know, and these, they're Rolls Royce, you know, they do it all. And then basically they will even help, you know, upload the book onto KDP Publishing, the Amazon platforms, Kindle. All that will be kind of done for you as part of the service. I'm not going to say exactly, but, you know, you're talking several thousand euro.
And just on that, just when you started page one, from then to the day it actually went on live online, how long was that?
It's a shocking amount of time, really. But then maybe I'm just like really slow. That's possible too. You know, we're talking 4 years.
4 years, yeah, I suppose.
But then I have another book cooking, and so, you know, it's just not going to be as long this time, you know, because I've learned so much. And plus, as well, you're confident. It's a big difference, you know, you're kind of a bit more confident in yourself. So, it would, you know, if somebody was full time writing, I suppose it would take a lot less time.
So you're up and running then, and you have your book published. How do you go about then promoting it? Is that your problem, or do they help you with that?
That is your problem. But, you know, increasingly, publishing companies whose lunch is being eaten by Amazon in a lot of cases have much lower margins. and they do not have the money to spend on marketing anyway. Mm-hmm. So even if you go through the traditional route, the advances are much lower and you have basically got to do all the marketing yourself. Mm-hmm. They will get you in to all the main retailers, right? So that's done. It's not like you have to do that yourself, because I'll come on to that in a minute. But basically, they'll get you into the bookshops, but they're not going to spend a lot of money promoting your book. You've got to do that yourself. You've got to set up a website. You've got to be tweeting. You've got to get on the radio shows nearly yourself.
And you and got into an American show recently.
I did indeed, yeah. So you have to get a bit creative. And now, I did hire a PR company, and I, like, literally threw not a huge amount of money at it, just a couple of hundred euro literally. But they did put the book into the hands of various radio shows and stuff. So that helped in Ireland. But in the States, recently, I had read this, it went global, this particular news piece about a compound which was discovered in New Mexican desert, which was run by this religious crazy guy, and he was basically training people to, you know, carry out terrorist attacks, kind of thing. But it was kind of his family members, and they had lived there remotely. Nobody knew they were there. And then all of a sudden, a note kind of got out saying, "Help us, we're starving." And then the FBI got involved, and it was this compound that was there for months. Mm. And that's exactly, I suppose, where my book kind
of goes.
It's
like a fictional place.
It is literally where my book goes. So I sent the book off to a lot of radio stations, newspapers, and in New Mexico, and I said, "Look, guys, you know, you don't know me. I'm Irish, but I said, go to chapter 16, and then I know you just wrote this article. Go to chapter 16 and just tell me this isn't life imitating art, or vice versa." And straight away I got a call back, and it was from basically a very well known broadcaster over there. And so I went on the radio, and sure enough, you know, like within a week, I saw a big pop in online sales, Amazon, so that's great. That's how things work. But you need to be a bit creative, and it's hard to get into the book wholesaler. That's the big thing, you know. So, yeah.
And how's it selling? How's the book selling generally? You don't have to give us numbers.
Yeah,
there.
Well,
sure,
I mean, I have certainly.
Anyway.
I've gone straight past the 250. Sure. Well, past that now. So I'm heading for 1,000 book sales now, for being honest. But I only launched it in March. And so, you know, it takes some, you know, the like, if basically a reasonable result, like, for instance, a big print run in Ireland now in the Irish market, even for well-known authors sometimes, is 3,000.
Yeah.
Like a year. So people have these. Yeah. Now, of course, there are the very big sellers and the very well-known, but the average is much, much lower, you know. So, and as well, you know, the lifetime of the book that I'm targeting over the next 3 years, that's really, I'm going to keep marketing this book for 3 years. And hopefully what you do is you build a number of reviews online on Amazon, Goodreads and various other platforms. And then through that, then the book develops its own legs. At the end of the day, if it doesn't sell eventually by word of mouth, there's nothing you can do. And it just, you move on to the next book, you know.
Okay, but selling. Where
it's doing well.
Where can it be bought in? But people get into the old fashioned,
so,
walk into the shop,
indeed.
Open the door, say, "Can I have this
I'm
book?"
I'm very glad to say, you could. I mean, it's in Dubray, it's in Hodges Figgis, it's in Bookhaven, locally here, and it's in many, many other retail outlets, booksellers.
And what price
Alan
is
Hanna.
It retailing? Can I ask?
Yeah, it's retailing at $12.90.
Yeah, excellent value.
And Barbara, could you tell us? I mean, how did you manage to get it into the retailers? You talked about getting online there.
That is really
just
that
briefly
is
give us a feel for that.
What you need to do is have done enough marketing. Like, I was very lucky. Joe Duffy had read the manuscript and liked it, and he launched the book for me. So
never heard of him.
Generate everything around. Try and get a big book launch, you know, and generate a bit of excitement around that. And then I got reported in the Examiner and the Independent. I got reviews, but basically that still didn't get me over the line. I had a line of communication with Argosy. They're the biggest wholesalers. But eventually what you need to happen is for bookshops to ring Argosy and say, "Hey guys, what about this Torchbearers? I've been asked for it by a lot of people coming to the shop."
Yeah.
And just sending, you know, your family, and that won't do it. You need more than that. You need evidence that you've been put out there marketing and so forth. And eventually, you know, it took months, but I did get it over the line and got my first order. And that was, you know, that was fantastic, because it's quite hard to get fiction titles, self-published fiction titles into the wholesaler. It's much easier, I think, to get self-help type books.
So all in all, just from a business point of view, it's been a good apprenticeship. Absolutely, 4 years. Mm-hmm. You had to come up with the artistic piece and write this wonderful book and the story which came out of your head, really good. And then you had to figure out a way of getting people to buy it by various means. You had to go on radio shows and market it and come in and see us and all that sort of thing. So it's a really good all around package of an embryonic business to get forward and to
completely. It's been such a learning curve, but you know, it's been very worthwhile. And please God, now then, if my next novel will run more smoothly as a result of.
And what is
I've
next?
Learned.
Can we ask you that as a final question?
Yeah, it's a contemporary thriller set in North County Dublin, actually. Yeah, so it's you know, kind of an urban thriller, an urban mystery. So, great. Yeah, so that's well underway.
Barbara Higgins, thank you for joining us at Near FM and Nearby Business, and we wish you every success with
you.
The Torchbearers by Barbara Higgins. Great book.
Definitely, and good luck with that. And you'll have to come back and tell us about the North Dublin set book when that comes out as well.
Please God.
Okay, well look, we're going to move on now. As I said, we have a double feature this week on the business of self-publishing, and thanks again to Barbara for telling us all about the Torchbearers and how she got that eventually published after a number of years. But earlier in the year, the Dublin Tech Summit was held here down the road in the conference centre. And Near FM's very own Declan Mina, he spoke with a lady there called Kinga from another self-publishing company called PublishDrive.com. They spoke all about self-publishing and the changes in that particular industry.
You can't judge an apple by looking at the tree. You can't judge honey by looking at the bee. Sister by looking at a brother. You can't judge a book by looking at the cover. Oh, can't you see? Oh, you misjudge me. I look like a farmer, but I'm a lover. You can't judge a book by looking at the cover.
My name is Kinga, and I'm from Publish Drive. We built a platform for book publishers and writers to help them publish all around the world.
So the publishing industry is really changing. You know, it's gone from books and, you know, it's gone from print to digital. It's gone from big publishers to maybe self-publishing a bit. So do you want to talk about that a bit?
Yeah, sure. So our primary market is on the self-publishing market and in the States. And what we can see that it's booming. So we have every day like hundreds of new publishers signing up and new authors signing up. And they actually are becoming like full-time writers because with us, they can get the full coverage all around the world. So they can get to the widest network of readers. And they actually can earn 3 times more than publishing only on Kindle, for instance. And it's pretty awesome to see how much control and power the new authors are having right now because of a new ecosystem what is actually growing.
So a lot of people probably know Kindle, maybe some people know iBooks, but what would some of these other platforms be?
Yeah, sure. Like Google Play, for instance, they have a books section as well. And obviously, all the Android phones, they are already tied in. There is Script, for instance, which is quite big in terms of the subscription market because there are different business models all around the world. And we are pretty much open-minded for all of them. And there is another platform called Overdrive. They are covering most of the digital libraries market. But we have partners in China, for instance, which is obviously a big market to tap foot into. We can see that they actually are reading English language books as well, so not just like Mandarin.
So you said something really interesting there, and I think with the music industry, they're moving away from buying tracks to a subscription model. So do you think publishing is going to go down more of a subscription model, and what would that be like?
Yeah, so we actually can see that many people are becoming more like subscription-based readers. Though I believe there are some books which people like to own, even in a digital way. And what I can see that, especially when it's about like fiction type of reading, people are becoming more subscription-based readers, and it is really important to list your books in these new models as well, because obviously if you are not there, then they actually are trying to find another way to get your books. And another thing is the digital libraries, especially on different markets where people are just going to the library and they are reading ebooks there, or they actually have access to the subscription what they actually own through the library, and they are buying or reading books like that for a period, like for 3 weeks, for instance, so they are lending. And these kind of business models are helping a lot, especially for a debut author who is a newcomer on the market, to get more coverage and get to the widest network of readers in overall.
So what was it like speaking at the Double Check Summit today? How did the talk go and what was your topic?
Yeah, we've been talking about the future of publishing. It was a panel discussion. And it was really great to talk with other people who are from the different parts of the industry. And we actually have been talking about AI, even about augmented reality, how the books actually can be enriched with different new content inside. And we've been talking about how people and how authors have to find the right audience with the help of AI. And I think that is one of the directions where we are going in terms of the whole industry. It has to be much smarter. And though it's a very traditional industry, but it has to apply all the innovation what is out there right now. So artificial intelligence is not like future anymore, it's in our present as well. So that's what we are trying to do, to implement it in our present and to make sure that the authors have these tools which help them to get much smarter publishing in the end.
So, if someone out there listening is thinking about publishing, I think you might recommend that they would self-publish, but what should they do? They have this novel on the shelf, or they're working on this novel. What should they do to self-publish it?
Yeah, so if you have an idea or only, then first of all, you have to write down all the ideas you have, and to make it for a good story, you have to, what I always say, that search for like your name. It's a very basic thing, but if you actually don't have a good name, then you should come up with a pen name to be unique, and then you actually can get discovered much easier later on. So to build your author brand, that's pretty important.
Yeah.
Then if you have the book ready, you might want to pay for someone who is helping on the editing side, because that's pretty important to get a good book. But if you don't want to do that, it's fine, because what I always say, that the ebooks are basically the minimum viable products of the book.
Okay.
So basically, you just publish it and you get a lot of reviews and you actually can see how you can improve it later on. But it's really important to actually get a new cover, a good cover. You can create it with Canva, for instance. So if you don't want to pay for a designer, you can do it on your own with a quite good quality as well. And what is really important to have a good description as well, because this is basically your marketing tool, the biggest and most powerful marketing tool you have about your book. And then what we always say, if you are a new coming writer, then the best way is to price your book for free in the beginning. And then if you are coming out with new series as well, then you actually can price your books higher later on, and you can get to more readers in the end, and you can build your author brand much better. And of course, if it is about the brand building for your own brand, you should have a social media websites, like obviously Twitter page, Facebook, Instagram. So you have to be active and you have to talk to your readers, because you have to build this relationship to make sure that you are actually becoming the author you want to be. And then you have to decide about the distribution, where you want to publish. You can decide to go only on Kindle, for instance, but you can get to all the stores as well. So in PublishDrive, for instance, you can select where you want to sell. So it's totally up to you what you want to do. But it's really important that you don't stop here when you are already published your book, because you have to analyze what's going on. So if you sold books, you actually have to dive into the data, and you have to understand who bought it, how you actually can improve your book later on, or how you can improve your description, for instance, to get into more readers. And it is an ongoing process, and I think it's really important to be humble and to learn as much as you can. And I'm really happy, because in our team. We have a very great like publisher coaches who actually are very helpful if a new author has some questions, and we are very happy to answer them and help them through the whole process.
Okay, and if someone wants to use your platform to self-publish, then what's the website?
It's publishdrive.com.
Coming up in the second part of the program, before the end of the show, Brian Green will be here and we'll be talking in a little more detail about Pirate.ie, his latest business venture. And after the break, we'll have David Bell from the HR department for his regular look at HR issues. And this week, David is talking to me about maternity, paternity and parental leave, again, from an employer's point of view.
Download the podcast and catch up on your listening at near.ie.
Near FM.
Social Fabric, Monday 4:30 PM on Near FM 90.3. Conversation with guests about their jobs, their passion, and how they interact and contribute to the community. With music chosen by our guests, we explore how some songs have lasting positive impact on them. Join us on Monday 4:30 PM on Near FM 90.3.
Join us,
David Murtha
and Catherine Reid,
every Saturday from 3 PM to 4:30 PM for Beef to the Heel.
A mix of country, folk, blues, rock and Irish music, and some chat as well.
Hi, many of you who will hear this will have been a patient or will have had a loved one as a patient at Kappa National Orthopaedic Hospital. Over the past 30 years, your generous donations of over 11 million euros have enabled critical developments at the hospital. This year is Kappa Hospital Foundation's 30th anniversary, and we want to do something special to continue to support the hospital. We've launched Kappa for Kappa, and we would love your support to raise more funds so the hospital can enhance patient care. It's really easy to organise a Kappa for Kappa. Get your friends together anytime, any place, anywhere. Contact us for more information on 01 834 0325 or log on to chf.ie.
This is Near FM
90.3.
Welcome back to the programme. I'm Declan Ralph. Don't forget, if you would like to get involved in the discussion or comment on any of the stories we have on the programme this evening, you can contact the show by text while we're on air to 087 69 44 500. That's 087 69 44 500. Or you can get in touch anytime on Twitter as well at @nearby_business, #localbiz.
Your HR questions answered on Nearby Business.
I'm joined now by David Bell for his usual look at our HR issues. David runs and owns the company called the HR Department. Tonight, David, we're going to talk about maternity leave and paternity leave. And I suppose the first question I have is, should I more correctly refer to it as parental leave nowadays?
No, actually, look, it is a bit confusing, Declan, and that is sort of a common query. So basically, in this general area when it comes to children, there are three different types of leave and some qualifying benefit as a result. So the first one that I suppose the people would be most familiar with would be for the mother, which is maternity leave, which is currently 26 weeks, which is if you're entitled to it, you get maternity benefit. That's not paid by your employer, but that's the state will pay you maternity benefit for those 26 weeks. And then an additional 12 weeks that can be taken voluntarily, but that's unpaid as far as the state goes. So that's the first sort of most common one. Then the next one is paternity leave, which is a relatively new legislative leave that is that the partner or the father of a child is entitled to. And that's 2 weeks that can be taken in the first 6 months of the birth. And that again has paternity leave benefit if you apply, if you have enough stamps, etc. That is again a state payment for those 2 weeks. I think it's €240 a week. And that is paternity leave. And then there is parental leave, okay, which is an unpaid leave.
Right.
And that is the one that, you know, has recently they flagged in the budget they're going to change. And that currently, where you have a child under eight, each parent is entitled to 18 weeks paternity leave. Sorry, parental leave, excuse me. And that is unpaid, and that can be taken in blocks of, you know, one block of 18 or two blocks, or an employer can agree to do it differently if it suits. So some people take parental leave maybe, you know, a week and then back, or even a day a week over. I've heard of that, where some people have taken a day a week over maybe a year, so they spread the 18 weeks out. So it's that parental leave, the big difference that we would have in this country relative to a lot of European countries is that there's no obligation on the employer to pay parental leave or paternity leave or maternity leave. So in this instance, the government have said in the budget that they've looked at all the different of those three leaves, and they feel the most beneficial is to start paying some of that parental leave. So some of those 18 weeks, and the suggestion is that it's going to be 2 weeks would be paid, to increase year on year if the money is there, of course, with a view to building it right up to the 18 weeks. That seems to be the plan.
Okay. And I suppose you mentioned amounts there that are paid. They're the statutory amounts, and they're paid for, in as you said, in the case of maternity leave, to 26 weeks. Would some employers top that up to the normal salary level, or would they pay a normal salary, you know, just as a sort of a goodwill payment anyway?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some, I wouldn't say a lot. I'd say, you know, to be honest, it depends on the industry. It depends on the business. It sometimes depends on the seniority or otherwise of the employee themselves. I think instinctively most employers would like to top up some or all of the benefit to make sure that the employee does have, you know, sufficient funds. It's a big time, it's a yeah. length, a significant length of time to be out of work if you're only receiving the benefit, particularly obviously if you then go on to take the additional maternity leave, which you don't get paid at all. So a lot of employers would like to do it, but I suppose when they look at it, then there is this difficulty that you're paying someone their full salary. They're not there sensibly, you know, 6 to 8 months, and they may have to be replaced during that time. So it is very tricky, but there are certainly employers who do. Some, Declan, attach, I would say, conditions, but there are some caveats to it that maybe certainly clients of ours, some of them may have paid half it,
okay,
and then they'll pay the other half, provided you return to work and stay for 6 months. So it's things like that.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
I suppose a lot of it is to do with why are you paying it? Is it because of loyalty? Is it to encourage the employee to come back because they feel a certain amount of gratitude or whatever it might be? So it is tricky, but people definitely do pay it. I know in the paternity leave, this was a big question in sort of in our world of HR and employment laws. Like, if you topped up maternity benefit, would you now be obliged to top up paternity benefit? Because if you didn't, could you be accused of discriminating against?
Indeed, yeah, yeah.
So again, that was a question, and some people felt that if you did one, you had to do the other, to be fair. And I can see the logic to that. So again, that then causes problems because now you have another group of employees who potentially, now again, it's only for 2 weeks. It's not as much of a financial impact as maternity leave would be, but it did have an impact on people. Yeah.
But there's no obligation on the employer to do it. It's an ex gratia payment or an agreed payment.
It's an agreed payment. Yeah. Some people agree it as part of their contract. It's their terms and conditions of employment that they will, or that's their policy. Others, as I say, do it a bit more ad hoc. Sometimes, you know, the employees might argue that it's custom and practice. In other words, that what was once a discretionary payment has been so paid so much over the years that in fact it has become a contractual right. But by and large, it's either a policy that the company have that they'll pay it, but very often you will see that they will reserve the right to withdraw it in, you know, in times of need if financially they can't afford it. They can, and again, I've seen that where people have given notice that, you know, as of a certain date, there will no longer be a maternity top-up. That obviously wouldn't apply to anyone who was out on maternity leave,
sure,
or who might have been pregnant at the time and they knew about it. but they suddenly, you know, they would give some notice. But that could be a temporary situation as well. But there is no statutory obligation to pay it.
Okay. And in these more modern times, I suppose, when there are lots of different family units, different family types, different types of parenting, I suppose you might describe them as. I mean, in terms of adoption, which has obviously been there for a long time, but I'm thinking of surrogacy. I'm thinking of, do the same rules apply to same-sex couples and so on? What's the sort of position in relation to some of those?
Yeah, so adoptive leave has its own entitlements. So adoptive leave is separate. It's similar to paternity benefits. So adoptive leave, there is a statutory adoptive leave, which would be along the similar lines. In terms of paternity leave, and adoptive leave, they talk about the nominated parent. So if he is a married same-sex couple, one of them is designated to be the parent to benefit from the leave.
Okay.
If it's only entitled to one person, then obviously in relation to parental leave, both parents are entitled to take it. But maternity leave is obviously solely for the mother, unless, you know, those tragic circumstances where a mother, in the very, very unusual situations where a mother may die in childbirth or very shortly thereafter, it can be transferred to her partner. But in the main, it is the mother who takes maternity leave, and in same-sex couples, a nominated partner takes the adoptive leave or the paternity leave, as the case may be.
Okay. And I know, just from reading your blog, you wrote an article there recently about tips for welcoming back someone from maternity leave. Would you give us a few of those tips again?
Yeah, well, I think it is a slightly tricky one, and I've had many conversations with female friends who have differing views on my theory of what's good and bad. I think maternity leave is what they call a protective leave. It is enshrined in law that is the only leave that which you can are guaranteed your job when you come back from it, provided you serve the sufficient notice. But it is one of those leaves that people feel. And rightly, in a way, that I've left the office, I'm looking after my child and my other children as well, and I don't really want to be bothered by work or people in work or anything like that. And I can completely understand it. But at the same time, businesses change very quickly these days. And if you're out of work for 6 to 8 months, things happen. Your boss could be gone. Some of your colleagues could have left. The business could have been taken over. So things change. And whilst you're entitled to return to work, to the job that you left within reason or a reasonable alternative, it's not available. You know, things are changing. That was, again, drafted at a time when maybe jobs didn't change that much. So what we try and suggest is that you have some sort of contact with the person, with their consent, of course. I mean, I'm not saying bombarding them and it's not work-related, but more information so that if things are happening or things are going on, that they are aware of what's happening when they come in. It's not such a strange feeling coming in after such a length of time. I think encourage visits during the maternity leave, if again they are prepared to come in and it's not too much of an inconvenience to the rest of the staff. And then when they do come back, I think there is an element, the majority of women returning from maternity leave are anxious, they're sometimes nervous, particularly if it's their first time, they're unsure how they're going to feel about leaving their baby, and at the same time they might be nervous how they might be perceived in work. So I think it is, you should, you know, there is a focus to be done on people returning, making sure they feel welcome, they feel part of the team, they get caught up. So in other words, going back to my original point, they're not walking in to be told, oh, those four people are all new. They need to know this beforehand and maybe have a, you know, treat them in some respects like someone who's starting again in the nicest way. You know, maybe lunch, maybe a catch up, have a meeting, welcome them back, make a bit of a fuss. I think that's very important.
Okay. And I suppose the other question is that in your own experience, again, and talking to people who've taken maternity leave and the experience of that, do you think that women in particular on the maternity leave, when they have such a long period of time off, that it actually, do they believe it affects their career prospects into the future, even though obviously it's clearly not supposed to?
Yeah, I think it possibly does, as you say. I think, you know, the people will generally strive to not, both the employers and the employees who are coming back, strive to make sure that that is not the case.
Yeah.
What I think, regrettably, statistics would show that it probably does. I think things are getting a lot better. I think, you know, workplaces are becoming more family friendly and more aware of the needs of everyone. But at the same time, there's no doubt that for whatever reason, it's still maybe perceived as a barrier to success and a barrier to promotion. Is there a solution to that? There's obviously plenty of women who are very successful and have, you know, got to the top or very senior positions in their organizations and have had children. Some very high profile situations. Politicians, the New Zealand Prime Minister recently had a baby and has managed to continue to work still maintain a bond and look after a child. So it's very challenging. There's no question about it. It's still probably one of the big issues that I think face women in the workplace. There's no question about it.
Okay, David, as usual, a comprehensive look at the, as you clearly explained to me, there is maternity leave, paternity leave, and then the parental leave as well. So thanks a million for that comprehensive look at that this evening.
Thanks, Declan.
Thanks, David. David Bell there from the HR department, and David will be back next week with another look at a HR issue from the employer's point of view.
And Brian Green is here with me now to give us more detail on something we started the discussion on last week, pirate.ie. I felt, Brian, we didn't give it enough time, and it's something that we're interested here, given we're a radio station, and Near FM, I suppose, grew out of the old Pirate North Dublin Community Radio, if I have the title right. I think I have.
You do?
Yeah. And
you were on it.
I was indeed, many, many, many moons ago. And I suppose, you know, there's a business side to this as well, you know, from your point of view, because you're running this as part of your own radio.ie business. So
there is. And if I were to say what my business interest in it is, it just, you know, it lay bare why I'm doing it. But I do it because I love radio. But it also, I'm starting off as kind of a radio consultant. So it lets people know that I'm about and I'm in the industry. So I'm putting on an event, and the event is going to invite everybody in, and it's got a cultural dimension to it as well. That is that I want to record people's stories for oral history. So that's kind of the tangential kind of interest in it, is that it'll also assist the business in that it's me doing things and letting people know that I'm in this space as well as them. And they've been in it for years, and it's kind of a celebration because December 2018 will be the 30th anniversary of the big close down of all the pirate radio stations. Remember, Minister Ray Burke was in the communications, Department of Communications, the Minister for Communications, and he decreed that all the stations should shut down and applied for licences, which many of them went on to become legal stations.
And I suppose the business of radio, given that we're a business programme, you know, it's a big business. There's community stations like ourselves. You've got lots of local stations around the country and in Dublin here as well. And obviously then the national players as well. But there probably wouldn't be a business of radio if it wasn't for the pirates.
Yeah, so throughout history, the grassroots have revolutionised radio. From the very beginning, it was amateurs who took an interest in what was going on and experimented, and they're ham radio operators of today. They moved the technology along, a bit like podcasting 14 years ago. Throughout the 60s, an Irishman sailed from Greenore port in Ireland to the English Channel and broadcast Radio Caroline. Ronan O'Rahilly was his name. And within the space of weeks, he revolutionised the radio in the British Isles. And then in Ireland in the 1980s, two employees of Ronan O'Rahilly, Robbie Robinson and Chris Carey, set up Sunshine Radio and did that in the Sands Hotel in Portmara, came to Dublin, set up a super pirate and started to revolutionise radio in this island.
And even though they were pirates, they were run very much as businesses first and foremost, and were big businesses.
Very much so. So they were making a lot of money.
Yeah.
And they were limited companies, and they were fully registered and were paying all their taxes, and they had trade unions, and they were paying their royalties where they were let. Sometimes there was disputes, they wouldn't be let pay their royalties, and there was plenty of disputes with the unions over especially the
NUJ. I remember a lot of
there was two strikes at Nova, and there was plenty of problems with staff in the NUJ out in Sunshine as well. I read from Patsy McGarry in the Irish Times.
Yeah, so you know, this is you're chronicling history here as well, if I've said that word correctly.
You did.
And you're also, but as you said, you're using it as a platform to launch your own business.
In a way, yeah. It's kind of like a big shindig and a party, and everybody come together. It's happening on the 20th of October and it's in the Ballsbridge Hotel in Dublin 4 from 2 to 5. It's a Saturday afternoon. There's nothing else on that afternoon. There's no sporting engagements or anything. So if you're free to go, if you're interested in the topic of radio, pirate radio and old radio in Ireland, if you've got a shoebox in the attic full of tapes or memorabilia, go up the attic, take the shoebox down, bring it out. We'll have historians there who want to look at the memorabilia and catalogue it. And between now and the 20th of October, there'll be a big announcement. I'm going to tease it here, but there's going to be a big announcement in relation to a pirate radio collection and what's happening to it in terms of it has been a mobile roaming museum around the country and something's happening to it. So stay tuned for that and you can hear more details about what's happening to that pirate radio collection.
Okay, and I presume you'll give us an exclusive on that, Brian.
I will, absolutely. Around the 2nd of October, there'll be a press conference, so I might get you something just before then.
Excellent.
But I tell you, we do have some sounds of what radio sounded like back then.
Yeah,
and
just before we hear the sounds, I know you to take it back to the business bit just for a second, in terms of you're showcasing the business here, you know, it's something that you're passionate about, so therefore you'll be definitely showcase your business in a good light. And you know, one of the things you said you want to do with the business is actually to show organisations and groups that, you know, radio is a medium that they can use to further their particular causes or their particular objectives or whatever it might be. Would it be worth their while coming along? Even though they mightn't be radio geeks like the rest of us, would it be worth their while coming along to sort of see Brian in action and see maybe how radio comes together and get a feel for it all?
Not on that particular
day. Okay.
But, you know, everyone's welcome. But yeah, they're not going to get that out of that day because,
okay,
you know, it's come in, register, and we'll send people to different corners to get recorded. And we want those people to have stories. But no, it is something kind of internal within
okay
the industry. So just registered the business recently and it's just ramping up and raring to go.
Okay. All right. So you have some sounds for us.
Yes, the first one I have, this is from the mid-80s. Now, cataloguing and dating hasn't been great on tapes, but this one comes from the middle 80s. It's a community radio station in Bray, kind of a forerunner to East Coast Radio, Bray Local Broadcasting, BLB in Bray, and they had this promo which is very much a push for what we're on here, community radio, and it's just followed with a little bit of an update as to what's happening in the Ballsbridge Hotel, but this is a promo about community radio.
There's a need for local radio, that community radio can be of a great service to the local people.
We've been pressing for many years for improvement and enhancement at every level in radio.
Different people have different views as to the form local radio should take.
A lot of people in this area are now aware of what community radio means.
In the end, in my view, it's the listeners who will dictate what form local radio takes, not the legislators, but the listeners.
I believe that nobody has the right to say we are the only people who can decide who can broadcast.
Competition will do RTE good, and it will also do the provincial press good.
Sure, yeah, I think it's a great idea.
Shout to the top for community radio.
Pirate.ie.
Join us on October 20th at 2 p.m. in the Ballsbridge Hotel Dublin 4 for all history recordings.
It's going to be the Anorak Meetup of the Year. Get your free tickets at pirate.ie.
I think I recognise Nails Mahoney at the end of that, do I?
There's Tracy Lee and Nails Mahoney did the promo for me, yes, and thanks to Tracy and Nails.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because it's you know, the business of the radio hasn't really changed in one sense.
It's
over the
very
years.
Much
the model
the same.
Is similar.
Yeah, mid-70s, RTE were getting out of sponsored programmes, getting into spot ads, and pirate radio was spot ads, and the commercial radio industry in Ireland is still very much spot ads. Everything I'm sure is going to change because I've just done a master's thesis on podcasting and its effects on the radio industry, and people's ears are moving to other places. And radio.
So video didn't kill the radio star, but something else might kill the radio star.
Nothing kills anything in the fashion that the Buggles said in the song, but things do change. So it was about a decade later after the Buggles that television started to hit radio with late night music channels and satellite music channels coming in. And that hit radio in a small way. It hit AM radio. But podcasting and streaming and music listening and Spotify and Pandora and these kind of things are hitting radio, not in a kind of a financial way just yet, but if the ears are moving, the advertising will follow the ears, and radio follows where the advertising book is spent. So I think radio are going to be getting involved in podcasting in a much bigger way very soon.
And do you think that all of we've been talking about there, about podcasting, the radio business, all that, do you think, and you mentioned RTE, and we've talked about local and commercial and community radios, do you think that all of that sort of, from the ground up as you described it, has actually made the business model in RTE a bit better?
Has the ground up? I think big institutions are like oil tankers and they turn around very slowly. Mm. So they are turning around slowly. I think the funding situation up in RTE is quite interesting, and that is what's changing their attitude and way to doing things at the moment, more so than what their competition is, because they are under pressure financially, so they will change. And yes, the grassroots brought us 2FM in 79, it brought us Millennium in 88, Millennium Radio, it brought us local radio in 1989, so the grassroots and piracy in its time does have an influence on the state broadcaster to modernise and to compete.
Great. And you also got a milestone this week in terms of your own business, in terms of getting your business name registered.
Yeah, well, I'm a sole trader, but I can register business names and get an RBN from the CRO, and they are the company's registration office. So if you have an RBN...
Don't cross them, Brian, in your business dealings. That's all I'd say to you. Keep the CRO on site.
Yeah. I don't actually have to do returns to them, though, as a sole trader, but a limited company has to get their returns in. But anyway, for about £25 buying online, I was able to register my company as... I tried to get radio.ie because that's my domain, but they don't allow you to register domain names as your business name, so I got the word radio. Just radio, and they gave it to me, so I've got it.
Brilliant.
Registered as radio.
Well done, and thanks a million for talking about the business of radio. Well, that's it for this week for Nearby Business. We'll be back at the same time next week. That's live at 6 p.m. here with Nearby Business on Near FM. In the meantime, don't forget, if you have a comment on any of the stories featured today or an idea you'd like to discuss with us, get in touch on Twitter at @nearby_business, #localbiz. So from Dave Daly and myself, Declan Ralph, we'll see you soon on the radio. Bye for now. Bye-bye.